So I really benefited from this collective phenomena. So it's a great pleasure and honor to speak here in this symposium, David Fest. I was extremely lucky to work with David, to have met him after the decadent era, I guess, and just before the new rise of string theory. So he was some wandering around to some extent in problem space, I guess, in physics. He spent a sabbatical, I believe, in Paris, in Ecole Normale, working with Marc Mézard on spingular theory, and produced a beautiful paper on the simplest spinglers, which I'll mention in a few moments. And then he spent some time in Israel. This was in 1984, and it was in that summer when I worked with him again on a spinglass problem on Potts glasses, and this is a work which I'll discuss briefly later on. And let me make sure that my machinery works. So this is the paper that came out of this work. But beyond that work, I found the time that I spent with David very intellectually inspiring, and this is an opportunity to thank him for that. And since that work, I had numerous occasions to discuss with David I guess everything, from spin glasses to neural networks to strings and to religion. I guess he tried to convert me to atheism, but unsuccessfully. Yeah, so maybe keep trying. But it's dangerous, you know. I was extremely impressed by his intensity of work, his imagination, his passion for attacking a problem, looking for the beauty of the solution, or and his physics intuition. And I hope that I gained some from those assets. Speaking of intensity of work, I must say that during that summer, his intensity put me in a rather difficult personal position. And the reason for that was that at that summer, June of 1984, my wife here, as you can see, was heavily pregnant, and was due to give birth actually any day, and I had to persuade her to wait until David and I will solve the problem, and I was fortunate enough that she agreed to do that. And indeed, a few days after David left back for the States, she gave birth to our twin boys. So this is one connection between the physics that I've done with David and biology. But that's not the connection that I want to focus on in my talk. The connection which I want to focus on is the quest for understanding manifolds of states in complex systems. In particular, what kind of organization, ground states or equilibrium states at low temperature of complex systems fall into. And in this context, spinglass theory, in particular the mean field theory of spinglasses, was extremely inspiring to many of us. Briefly speaking, at that time, at the early 80s, we were all excited by the mean field solution of an Ising spin glass, where the spin variables are just plus minus ones, and the coupling constants are independent random variables. And it turned out that this system is not simply at low temperature freezing into some random glassy states, but the mean field theory revealed a beautiful structure of how these frozen states are organized. So first of all, the first message was that there is an enormous number of degenerate or quasi-degenerate frozen states that the system can fall into at low temperature. And then already at the dynamic mean field theory of that model on which I worked at the early 80s revealed that the dynamics is characterized by not simply a distribution of long time constant, but actually they are organized into hierarchies. But later on, soon after Parisi's analysis of the Parisi solution of the equilibrium replica symmetry or broken symmetry solution, revealed the full structure of the manifold of ground state of spin glasses. And briefly, this is a figure from David and Mazar's paper. Briefly speaking, they organize into an ultrametric or tree structure where the states are can be thought of sitting in valleys within valleys, and the similarity between them, the order parameter, which is the simply the overlap between pairs of states, are following the tree structure where there is an order parameter which denotes the similarity between states in a small valley. Then, of course, there is an order parameter which denotes the freezing within a valley, and so on. And then, and ultimately, a small value Q0 of an order parameter which characterizes the similarity between states which are further the furthest apart. So the mysterious order function Q of X, or the multiplicity of order parameters, turned out to reveal this hidden hierarchical structure of ground states. Now, the calculation of properties of that particular model has been technically very demanding because of this structure of having an order function or an enormous number of order parameters. it was in that context that David and Marc Mézard came up with a model which in some sense is much simpler, and therefore it is the simplest spin glass, again one of the names that David introduced into the jargon. And that model has the structure of a p-spin interaction where the coupling is not a two-spin but has multiple spin interaction, and obviously the simpler limit is when the p goes to infinity. And what they found is that in that case the structure of ground state is simpler. At low temperature the system is getting trapped into many valleys. Each one of these states or valleys has a frozen structure and therefore non-zero order parameter. However, the overlap between different states is zero. So one can think about it as sort of a one level of hierarchy, just one a set of leaves, and then so two order parameters, the order within one state and zero overlap between states. For many reasons, this model uncovered beautiful physics which is related to random energy model that Derrida has solved, and this raised the question whether one can get similar phases in systems which in some senses are more physical, namely two-spin interactions, although still mean field. And for this reason, and also for growing interest by experimentalists in systems which are not Ising, which have more complicated symmetries or don't have any simple symmetry. We have turned our attention to the POTS model, the POTS glass. In that case, there is a two-spin interaction which is random and again has a structure of mean field. However, the spin variables now have one of p states, and therefore for p bigger than 2, it of course defines different classes of models. And what we have found is that the structure of the manifold of states evolves with temperature. So unlike the simple Ising spin glass, where below transition temperature the full hierarchy is already there, here it comes in stages. So the first stage, when the system is cooled down below T1 or the critical temperature, a structure similar to the simplest spin glass appears. There are an enormous number of states which are frozen, has some random order in them, but they have zero overlap between them. However, as one cools down the system below temperature T2, then those states develop the full hierarchy of states like in Ising spin glasses. So in that sense, the system, the structure of the manifold of the ground states develops in temperature as one reduces temperature. It would be nice to have a model where actually each stage in the hierarchy appears at its own temperature. To my knowledge, such a model doesn't exist. So in some sense, it is disappointing that below T2, the full levels here already appear. And therefore, if one looks at, again, at the order parameter or the order function, Parisi order function, then at the intermediate temperature, there is only two levels, Q0, which is zero, and then the Q1, which is the freezing within one valley, and then below T2, there is the whole continuum of values, which is denoted by having a continuum, a continuous piece to the order function Q of X. Now, there are, it turns out that this model gave us more than we asked for, and in particular for pod states p bigger than 4, the transition from paramagnetic disordered state to the Pott's glass state is discontinuous. But unlike normal first order transition, it doesn't have a latent heat. So the order parameter, the freezing within each one of the valleys, does not vanish as one hit the system to TC. However, above TC, this state seems not to exist. If you look at the free energy as a function of temperature, above TC, there is only the paramagnetic phase. Below TC, paramagnetic state, although it has lower free energy than the Pott's glass phase, it is unstable, and then the Pott's glass state is the physical state. So there are several anomalies here. First of all, to choose a state which is higher in free energy than a lower one, but stability conditions can justify it. But the question is, what happens as you heat the system across TC? This branch, the Pott's glass branch, doesn't exist, seem to exist even as a metastable state, as in ordinary first order transitions. Although here, from this picture, we would expect that some sort of frozen state will be locally stable at higher temperature. It turns out, as found later on by Ted Kirkpatrick and others, that the frozen states appear above TC via a dynamic singularity. And this is one case where one can actually have a model, although in a mean field level, where at a finite temperature, the dynamic functions generate singularities which do not appear in the free energy. And this inspired renewed interest in trying to model true glasses, where apparently there is no true phase transition, but perhaps there is a critical temperatures, a critical points where the dynamics develops a singularity. Okay, so After that period, David wandered back into S-matrix theory, or so-called string theory, and I and many of my colleagues became interested in neural networks and then modeling brain function. And the first model that we studied was the Hopfield model for associative memory, and this model was actually comforting. I would say like relaxation relative to the spinglass complication because the structure of the ground states is rather simple. So here the interactions are random but are not independent for each bond because they are made out of outer products of states. S mu, mu goes from 1 to p states. And these S mu's are going, if there are not too many of them, are going to be the fixed points of the system or the ground state of the system. So if one thing one looks at the phase space of the system, one has these discrete states which are now don't emerge sort of spontaneously, but are really encoded or fully determined by the way we designed the interaction matrix GIJ. And this seemed to be a very useful analog of associative memory, where by learning procedures, one creates the valleys, the ground states, at the right places in phase space, and then each valley corresponds to a memory where one starts with some initial state close to it, and then one the dynamics of the system will converge the state to the desired memory, so to do pattern completion or associative retrieval of memory. From the point of view of a manifold of states, it's rather simple. Just have, although many states, but as I said, they are put by hand, so to speak, by the design of the interaction matrix. On the other hand, this is something that is rather useful for in the context of biology because the spinglass hierarchy seem to be too sensitive to the randomness of the couplings GIJ, namely the actual identity of the individual states. If there are any relevant to biology, one would like states that are accessible by external stimuli, or can be modified by learning, and so on. And indeed, several of us have attempted to sort of generalize the Hopfield model in such a way that hierarchy of states will emerge. It boiled down then at the end that all these, or most of these attempts, simply put by hand hierarchy of states in the memories that one put in the system. And that's, of course, something which is not so desirable. What we want to understand in the context of brain processes is how hierarchies emerge naturally from learning, from interaction with the environment, and so on. And indeed, hierarchy seems to be a fundamental feature of cognitive processes, of perception, of the way we organize knowledge, language, and so on. However, to this day, I don't think we have a good model sort of to generalize or soften the spinglass scenario so that hierarchy such a hierarchy will actually develop from the dynamics of the system. However, there is a reduced problem rather than to look for a theory of cognition. A problem which is more concrete, and this is invariant recognition. So if I go back to the memory paradigm, if I think about these states, memorized states as, let's say, objects, now there is a clear problem in this picture because we recognize objects under many, many transformations like positions, rotation, orientation, scale, and so on. Now, if we start to put each such instantiation as another discrete state, the system will saturate very quickly. So there is must be some different principle of organizing the phase space to allow for invariant recognition. So one possible idea is that instead of thinking about discrete fixed points as representing objects or concepts and so on, we should think about a manifold of continuous attractors, which each one of such a manifold represents an object. So different manifolds will correspond to different memorized objects. The degrees of freedom within a manifold of states will correspond to different scale positions and orientations and so on of the same object. So then the full picture, the caricature of the phase space of a neural network which will realize this idea will be that you have basins of attractions which split the phase space, but in their core, rather than having points, you have maybe strings. I don't know if they're heterotic or something else, but either lines or closed loops or even subspaces, which again correspond to different transformations of the same object. Now, this is a nice story, perhaps, but the question is how to actually realize such a situation in reasonable dynamics. Now, to have a discrete fixed point is something which is generically stable, structurally stable in nonlinear dynamical system. But to get such a degeneracy, continuous degeneracy, it seems to be much more difficult. So this will be again something like perhaps a simplest, not spinless, but a simplest mode of recognition, where you have different objects here, and each object will correspond to a multiplicity of a continuous manifold of states corresponding to the different invariant realizations of the same object. The first concrete system where we have tried this idea correspond to understanding some of the one of the old and perhaps most studied process of sensory cortex, namely orientation selectivity in primary visual cortex, namely the mechanism by which cells in the visual cortex detect orientation of visual stimulus. So this is perhaps an asymptotic vision. Okay, so the basic facts are very simple. If you look at cells in the retina, they have circular response profile. So they don't care, individual cells, about orientation of the of the object. Similarly, cells in the thalamic relay station. But if you look at the primary visual cortex, the story is very different. If you look at the activity of a single cell there, you see that it's many cells are highly selective to the orientation of the object. Cells will have typically a single preferred orientation, meaning for that particular orientation they'll fire strongly, and then for other orthogonal rotations they'll hardly be active. So typically you put on the screen in front of an animal such a stimulus, and you measure the total response property of that. Ignore different curves, just look at one curve, and you measure the response as a function of the orientation. There is a sharp peak at the preferred orientation of the cell, and then the response falls off sharply beyond it. So the question is, what is the mechanism that makes cells in visual cortex break the isotropy of their response relative to previous stages of visual processing? So before addressing that, I would like to point out that if you look at how topographically neurons in visual cortex organized with respect to their preferred orientation, you find the famous pinwheel architecture discovered by Greenwald and co-workers and others, in which you have patches around singularities, patches or columns of neurons which are selective for given orientation. So that's maybe oblique orientation, this will be vertical and so on. And so in most of the areas in cortex, the preferred orientation will smoothly vary, except for these pinwheel singularities.
How large are those patches in numbers?
The stimulus.
No, how large are
the patches? Oh, this patch may be 300 microns. Okay, so the classical picture how such an orientation preference emerges is very simple. It already has been put forward by Hubel and Wiesel in their seminal work. We discovered this property of simple cells, and simply that the input to the cell is geometrically organized so that it combines many cells in the previous stage, but the cells that are input to a single cell in cortex the input are organized in geometric fashion so that a given cell receives input from a select array of LGN cells which have receptive fields aligned in particular orientation, and therefore the organization, the geometric organization of the input to the cells in cortex is responsible for that property. Now, there are several difficulties with that story. One difficulty is shown here. If one takes that seriously and model this feed-forward input to a cell in cortex, one finds the following. If the visual input is increased in amplitude, namely in contrast, then the overall level of input to the cell increases, and therefore also the overall activity should increase, and which means that one should expect to see that for low contrast stimuli, the perhaps maybe sharp orientation tuning, but for high contrast stimuli, cells will be active at all orientation. And now the question is it so? And the answer is that negative, that this is a well-known feature of orientation tuning, that it's contrast invariant. You increase by a factor the amplitude of the input and also the amplitude of the response, but the tuning width remains unchanged. So when we observe experimentally some sort of invariance, it calls for a non-trivial explanation for that. Now there are of course other problems in the simple story, and a basic problem is it doesn't fit the architecture of cortex. If you look at cells at the input stages of cortex, most of their input is actually coming from their neighbors' cortical cells. Only 7 to 15% of the input coming from the feedforward from previous stages, and therefore one should it calls for an explanation of what is the role of the cortical feedback in such a system. So in 1995 we suggested a rather simple-minded idea that maybe cortical input cortical feedback is acting like a symmetry breaking to endow the neurons with this orientation selectivity feature. So if one takes a simple-minded ring model where cells are arranged in a ring which are indexed by the preferred by an angle, which is the preferred orientation, and one assumes that the interaction between neighboring cells had this Mexican head profile, namely excitatory for nearby cells and negative antiferromagnetically for cells which are far away, something which is typically observed in cortex, and on top of it there is an external input which is maybe weakly tuned. One can ask, maybe there is some noise, temperature, one can ask whether such a system at low temperature, what will be the state of such a system. In particular, what is interesting to ask is what happens if the external input is just uniform? And this boils down to a very simple question. You take a piece of cortex and you activate it by just a uniform input. And the question is, will the system respond in a homogeneous fashion, or there are some intrinsic states which will be revealed, which will be characterized by spatially inhomogeneous states of activity? And
4 minutes.
Wow. Okay. So what we have found is a simple pattern formation problem. And as you go down to low temperature, or you increase the spatial modulation of the interaction, you go from a homogeneous state to what we call now a ring attractor, where the intrinsic states of cortex are hills of activity, which can be of course anywhere. And if one then add to it an external input will select one of them in regular symmetry breaking fashion, and the shape of these states will be determined by the cortical range of interactions, whereas the amplitude will be determined by the amplitude of the stimulus. So this is a simple explanation of contrast invariance in orientation tuning, but there are other predictions. Now, one prediction is that one expects to see fluctuations in long timescales if you have broken symmetry. And there's still controversy and question mark whether they exist in that system. But there is a more basic question, whether at all, if one looks at spontaneous activity in cortex, does one have special patterns of activity or not? And for a long time, this seemed to be hopeless to actually dream of such a situation, because all microelectrode causing didn't reveal any structure in the spontaneous activity of the brain. However, recently Sodics et al. Reported a very revealing and interesting experiment where they actually show that suggest that the spontaneous activity actually involves the same special patterns as those that involved by a visual stimuli. And if you focus here, you see the same. These are activity maps generated by a particular grating of given orientation, so this patch is active and this patches are not active. If you look at the spontaneous activity at different times, you find similar patches and so on in that example. So this is the first experimental evidence that the spontaneous sort of the vacuum state of visual cortex is not trivial, is not homogeneous, but it actually better correspond or better should be described as fluctuations of transitions between different intrinsically generated states. Now there is still, of course, a question about these experiments, but this is at least an evidence in the right direction. Okay, so I have to finish, I guess. Okay, so let me just mention just one more idea that came out in the context of other system in the brain, where instead of where the manifold of states have been used not only to code for stationary stimuli, but actually to integrate a time-dependent stimulus velocity across the manifold of attractors. So the idea is that by modifying the dynamics of the system, one can actually generate selective dynamics along the manifold of attractors rather than in other parts of phase space, and these selective dynamics can perform or realize interesting computations such as integrating velocity into position. But I don't have time to elaborate on that. In that case, just I'll briefly show the system is basically similar to what I had before, but now one adds an asymmetric component to the interaction. So the interaction between two cells now have asymmetric component, is derivative of the symmetric part, and the prefactor of that part correspond to an external velocity, and one can actually solve this model and show that the system in that case generates simply moving hills where the instantaneous velocity correspond exactly to the external one. So one should think also of possibilities that there is dynamic modulation of the effective interaction into the system, which codes for information which can be then realized by the final state of the system. Okay, so let me then close by summarizing a few of the points that I wanted to tell here. There are some common themes between spin glasses and brain models. In both cases, we look for mechanisms that generate enormous degeneracy of stable states. In both cases, there is no obvious simple order parameter global symmetry, although in the particular model that I discussed, I showed here, we invoke we assumed a spatial global symmetry, but in more reasonable and realistic models, symmetries correspond, advances, perceptual advances are much more complicated than simple global symmetries. There are scales and distortions and so on, and therefore we are really searching for mechanisms that generate this anomal degeneracy without without relying on simple global symmetry. In both cases, we look for mechanisms. In one case, we know, but in other case, we still don't know. But hierarchy should be an important part of how the manifold of states are organized. However, there are very important differences. One, first of all, is robustness. Any model which does not allow for substantial quenched or thermal kind of dynamic noise is unrealistic for a model of brain function. And as I said earlier, these states, which maybe the number of which may be enormous, have still to be relatively simply identified by external cues to actually correspond to some computation. So they should be rapidly accessible by external cues, and also they should be modified. The landscape should be modified on broad timescales, because for all we know, learning and plasticity in the brain occurs at an enormous range of timescales. And therefore, we are still, even though we made progress in understanding spin glasses, we are still at the primitive period, so to speak, of understanding even the simplest function of neural networks in the brain. And this is, I think, time to actually challenge again David, perhaps this time to help us discover the model for the simplest brain.
Yes, Edouard?
And since your model are now physiologically more closer to reality, is the assumption of symmetry of the JIJ not worrying?
Well, they're very extremely worrying. This is why, this goes under the robustness assumption. So in other words, this is all the models that, on the one hand side, there are several experimental systems that really need such a degeneracy of states. The system which I mentioned is the least one of them, because you can always say it's coming from feedforward, but there are models which correspond to navigation and to generation of motor commands and so on, for which we don't have any other explanation but something which invokes a mechanism of the sort that I've spoken about. Symmetry, symmetry is only a very good approximation at all in those systems. However, there is learning, okay? And one possibility is that the system is always updating the connections or other parameters of the system to balance out the effect of noise on and asymmetry. So the system has other avenues of flexibility than as relative to usual physical systems.
Kurt.
I was just going to ask, in the experimental demonstration that there are identified under vacuum states of a large number, there must be experimental and observational transitions between
right.
vacuum states.
Right.
Is that dynamic something that
So it is, well, it's only the experiments by Zodics and Greenwald and Arielli and Weitzman are only now being fine-tuned enough to actually now probe the transitions. But the transitions are on the order of a few hundred milliseconds. So there is now emerging data, but it's very preliminary, which actually gives statistics about these transitions. I think safely say it's an order of a few hundred milliseconds. So if the microscopic dynamics is of the order of 10 milliseconds, we are talking about maybe one or two orders of magnitude by which you can talk about something which is quasi macroscopic.
We are a little bit pressed.
Kind of you're talking about the patterns you see in front of the horizon.
Okay, this is it's an interesting. It's another angle on this. The question is whether when we close our eyes, there are patterns, but so far the patterns that people reported are more global than I discussed here. Although Jacobin and Bartem and Trout and have long time studied spontaneous patterns. If you close your eye, in addition, you take some drugs and so on, what kind of patterns appear there. The pattern that I'm talking here are more local in scale, and they invoke non-linearity and so on. So they were talking about much more global structure of activity.
We are a little pressed for time, but we have time for two questions. One from Stephen.
So a related question is, there must be some mechanism that projects this from taking over your visual field.
Whether the perception will
you don't want the perception to be influenced.
Right. Okay. So I must warn you first of all that these experimental results are preliminary. We have a program now I'm being a salesman on behalf of David, a program at ITP on these questions late summer and fall. So first of all, these experimental results are preliminary, so one should take them with a grain of salt. And secondly, from that primary visual cortex to perception, there is a long way, and many mechanisms of adaptation and scaling out effects are there at work.
Question from Jim.
What?
That's all right.
You
can go on for hours.
Oh, you can go on for hours? Okay.
But not me.
Well, thank you very much.